has your thinking face on.
I know, I do.
Erin has her thinking face on. Go ahead, Erin.
Listening to the Lutheran Ladies Lounge podcast. I'm Sarah.
I'm Erin.
And I'm Rachel.
It's a kitchen table talk episode. These are some fan favorite episodes because we talk about all kinds of stuff with a pastor.
Yes, we save up all the hot topics that are slightly above our pay grade and then invite someone else and talk about them with us.
Yes. So, Rachel, what topic do we have on the table today?
So, our topic today is one that hits very close to home for me as someone who has made my career, such as it is, out of writing and editing. A number of decades ago, automation came for the factory workers, but now automation is coming for my industry. And so, it's very personal this time. And so, I'm very, very interested in the topic of artificial intelligence. And while we could talk a lot about the technical possibilities, and I'm sure we'll touch on that at some point, I really, really wanted to talk about this with somebody who's good at ethics. And the person I know who is the best at ethics and also happens to be a pastor is our guest today. We have in the studio with us the Reverend Dr. Scott Stiegemeyer, who teaches theology, church history, and bioethics at Concordia University, Irvine. He's been on this program before, and we love to have him. So welcome back, Pastor Stiegemeyer.
Well, thanks for the invitation. I love being on here with you guys.
All right. We need to get into this because this is a pressing topic. As we record this, it has been in the news all week that China's new, is it Deep Creek app?
Deep Creek.
Okay, whatever it is, I only read the news this morning. You wouldn't think I'd forget. Is making waves everywhere and promising that AI is not going away. So my first question for you, Pastor Stiegemeyer, when we posted in the lounge a few days ago and asked our ladies to submit questions for this episode, a significant percentage were along the lines of, how can I take AI off my devices? And is there a way of detecting and avoiding it? Mm-hmm. Now, we all know that new technology always has made people uneasy at first. But is there something about artificial intelligence in particular that is especially troubling for people? Why is everyone so scared of AI?
Yeah, you're right. With every new technology, probably from the very beginning of human history, people have been skeptical or even afraid of, you know, the ways that new technologies may change humanity or insult God, right? So I was doing something on a related topic a while back on how visual media affects how we think. And back then, I came across something from Plato, one of Plato's dialogues, where I'll keep it simple, but he basically has two characters speaking who are discussing whether or not literacy, writing, is a good thing or not, because it's a technology, right? I mean, it's something that requires specialized knowledge and specialized tools and the skills to use them. It can take a long time. So, of course, Plato's writing this, but this is supposed to be in deep history, way back between an Egyptian king and an inventor, etc. So the one inventor invents writing and takes it to this king and says, here's what I created. Look what it can do. And the king said, no. This is bad because if you write everything down, then people won't remember things. And so that was Plato's point, that even something that we take for granted and maybe not even think of as a technology, it is, because it's created by human beings. And so I think that makes sense. I think that it is, there's truth in that. If you can just write everything down, then you're not memorizing it or remembering it as a community. So writing can also increase individualism. I'm hugely in favor of literacy. You know, our holy, the word of God is in scripture. So, but that's just an example of how people have often thought And there's many, many examples of things like that, right? Organ transplants, being able to fly. People mm-hmm. have wondered whether we should, just because we can do it, does that mean we should do it? And a lot of times these things, we get used to it, we start to appreciate the advantages, and then rely on those things. And it changes life, and it changes how we view life. I mean, clocks change how we view time, the telegraph change how we view communication, et cetera, et cetera. So this, it seems obviously natural that this would, like other technologies, be confront skepticism, and et cetera. I do think it's different, though. And, you know, we're all bound by kind of our time. I mean, I don't know what I would say 20, 50 years from now, but I think it's different. And I can tell you why. Because the one thing that makes humanity most human or most distinct from other living creatures is the word, right? Mm-hmm. And reasoning. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so logos, right? We learn in the Greek that logos means word, but it also means mind or reason. And you know, the Son, the Logos, becomes incarnate in Christ. And yet we are like Christ. We are created in the image of God in that way. And so to delegate off my ability to, you know, like a technology like shoes, right? Mm-hmm. It makes me able to walk more because then injure my feet. Okay, that enhances one of my abilities, but that's not as part of the God-ishness of humanity as, say, helping me think, right? Or supplementing, or not even that, replacing human thinking and speech or writing, or even creating images, right? Those sorts of things. Now, those are being done by our tools. And I think that changes, just like other technologies change how we view human life. I think that alters human life in a way that is more personal and more hard-hitting, with greater potential for harm.
Yeah. You mentioned shoes as a technology. You put them on your feet and they help you walk. Mm-hmm. They don't do your walking for you. And even if they did, walking is not the most essential attribute of a human being in the way that thinking and speaking are. Mm-hmm. Oh, well, thank you. That you said very clearly what I've been struggling to formulate for a while now. So I appreciate that.
Well, I'm glad to help as much as I am able to. Yeah. I mean, that's, you know, other animals, you know, I mean, the animals can walk, right? I mean, many animals can walk, many animals. So eyeglasses can enhance, or like telescopes can enhance the human capacity to see. Well, those are things that other creatures can do. But what makes humanity unique is our capacity to use words and think that way and reason things. Animals can communicate, other, you know, so forth. But human beings are in a class by themselves in this way. And that makes us, I think that must be part of what it means to be created to be like God, image God. And so this is much closer to that capacity than other capacities.
Yeah, I think a big concern for a lot of people is that, you know, you hear on the news about the chatbots, like you're conversing with something and it seems like it's interacting in a semi-human way, but it's not human, and you know it's not. And that just, like, it makes me feel a little weird that I'm talking with something that doesn't have a body and soul. Like, it's just, it's strange. And yeah, I think what you're describing, I think, is why that feels strange. But, like, should we be concerned about this, of like talking with these things that are not actually human but are kind of acting as human? Is this something that is concerning, or are we just kind of, you know, being too overly cautious about technology?
I mean, I think it is concerning. Way back in the early days of computing technologies, there was Alan Turing, T-U-R-I-N-G, right? And so there's the Turing test. Mm-hmm. And the Turing test was, if you are communicating with a computer in a way and you cannot tell whether it's a computer or a human person, then is there any meaningful difference between the computer and a person? And so I think that's what we're seeing, right? We're finally seeing that, where we can be, you know, fully deceived, or, you know, if it's not meant to be deceptive, fooled, or, you know, become unaware, maybe intentionally unaware, that we're not speaking to, there's no one there. Yeah. there's actually no one there. And so, yeah, that is concerning. I think it can soften the concern or mitigate it if we're at least aware. we know that this is happening, that what we're talking to, where it, and that may have, it may have its own dangers, but what is even more dangerous is if we begin to forget that we're talking to artificiality, that there's no one there, and develop bond, you know, an emotional bond with no one and nothing. And that can become love. I mean, you know, there's all sorts of people fighting, you know, using these kinds of technologies as potential ways to fight loneliness in the elderly, or people are creating, so I hear, they're creating avatars or whatever as girlfriends, you know, virtual girlfriends, et cetera, et cetera.
Well, and I saw a poll just today on a local news site. The question they asked all their readers today was, would you use AI therapy?
Ooh.
Yeah.
I know.
I've seen that. Well, there are apps on your phone that can do it. Yeah. Well, I mean.
So, you know, friends, girlfriends, and therapists could all be nothing.
Yeah. There's literally no one there. And now, I mean, I've seen apps like you can get on the phone. If it's simply, if what by therapy, what we mean is simply kind of, you know, calculation, you say this, is that accurate? Somebody asks you, is that accurate? Have you thought of this? All right. But the therapeutic relationship, right? As far as I understand it, the therapeutic, and even pastorally, right? I mean, the therapeutic relationship is built on more than algorithms, right? You know, there's trust, right? There has to be trust. There has to be personality. There has to be a sense of that this, you know, one that I am speaking with has empathy, right? And not the facsimile of empathy, but that there's actually emotion there. There's feeling, there's soul, right? And yeah, I mean, I think some things like what we're talking about now are merely just representations, and they can, it seems to me to be really a problem if we begin to replace actual human interactions with these other things. And it might be because we don't have any real choice, nobody in our lives. So there's a lot of things going on.
So obviously this technology is here, and from certain perspectives, it's very exciting. There's a lot of potential there, not just to take away my job.
Or mine.
Or yours. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. A lot of potential. Yeah. And you've talked some about the ethical concerns. Can you talk more about this? Put your pastor hat on and tell us, from a moral theological standpoint, what should we be thinking about here? Is this another first article gift of God, or is it something in a different category?
Yeah, I mean, that's how I would have first started off. You know, thinking of the Apostles' Creed, God is our creator, the first article of the creed. God has created not only us, but he continues to sustain our bodies and lives with all these gifts that he gives to us. And part of what God gives us is my reason and all my senses.
Yes.
And we use those things, right, to develop medicines. That's God providing medication for you, right? You can be delightful, or, you know, wonderful meals, or beautiful things, right? There's so many, or tools, right? These are so many things that though humans' hands may have made them and ingenuity may have made them, it is God giving us those almost godlike abilities to create and devise. So I think we should, you know, we shouldn't be the type of Christians that were otherworldly, that were so removed from the created order that somehow it's all kind of, you know, beneath spirituality, or that the material world somehow is a stumbling block to spirituality in itself, which it's not, because God is the creator of everything, and it's good in its you know, creator's intention. So I think that's a really good place to start, Rachel, is to say, let's not become so suspicious of things that we cannot appreciate the good things that make our lives better, and in those ways can serve our neighbor and bring glory to God, which is really the meaning of life. But we can also use those God-given capacities, such as ingenuity and skill, to do bad things, right? And create things that, everybody has good intentions when they do evil at some level, right? Right. I mean, it's like, you know, I mean, the roads to atrocity are just because people are trying to make the world a better place. So let's use, you know, concentration camps. We're making the world a better place. Euthanasia, we're making the world less suffering. Now, I'm getting off topic, but what I mean to say is that it is possible for us to use these God-given materials and so forth in ways that are not serving our neighbor and do not bring glory to the intentions of the creator. So is this one of those things? Where does this fit? And partially, I think it depends on usage, right? I mean, there are things that could be in themselves neutral, you know, like a hammer, right? I mean, it's a good thing when I'm using it to build you a house, but it's a bad thing if I'm trying to murder my neighbor with it or torture an animal, all those things. So these tools that we create can be used to serve our neighbor, or they can be used to damage our neighbor and try to exalt ourselves as gods. And I think this, you know, my first kind of assertion is that, look at it that way, that some extent, how is this being used? But I would go beyond that even and say, okay, but there are some things that no matter how you use them could still harm people. And I'm going to use another technology as an example. And don't think that when I say some of these things that I'm being like a Luddite in terms of like anti this totally. But let's talk about television, okay? Or video, right? Which has become such a part, especially, you know, in the recent decades, you know, such a part, or even like right now, we're using video technology to communicate. And that's good, right? That's wonderful. But we should be aware that pretty much any technology does change our humanity some way. There was a communications theorist in the popular in the 60s and 70s named Marshall McLuhan. Mm-hmm. You know, his book, The Medium is the Message.
Yes.
And one of his principles was, now he's talking more things about like media, writing, images, and television and radio, things like that. But he did kind of foresee things like the internet. But one of his points was that for every tool that we create, it enhances one human capacity, but also weakens another one. Mm. Now, I haven't thought through every technology I can come up with to see if that holds true. But I think sometimes it does. Just like Plato, right? Writing can mean that you don't remember things. Just like being able to look things up on the internet, you maybe don't remember facts because it's so easy to just, you know, find it.
Yep.
But my personal favorite example of that happening is GPS.
Oh,
right.
No.
Now I use GPS almost every day.
Yep.
You know, even if I'm going home on a route I've gone 1,000 times, maybe traffic is bad. So, you know, I want GPS to tell me how can I reroute or why is it taking so long? Oh, there's a wreck. So years ago, in the olden days, I was a pastor in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Yay, right, Sarah? Yay.
Yeah.
Right. You got family there.
Yeah.
And I was a pastor there and loved it. But Pittsburgh, if you don't know, it's a great city, but it's kind of hard to get around. It's hard to navigate, right?
And
it's very
bridges
difficult.
Bridges everywhere.
Bridges, tunnels, roads to, nowhere, roads to nowhere.
Yeah.
I have some pretty funny anecdotes about trying to travel. But during those days, GPS was so new that almost nobody had it, practically speaking. And so when I first moved there, it is a difficult city to get around because of all these reasons we've been saying. And you just have to learn by trial and error, and you use maps. And even those don't always help you much. But after a while, you get in your head, there's north, there's south, the river's over here, right? When I can see the smoke, that's factories there, right? You learn where you are. Mm-hmm. You have a greater sense of place and space. And this becomes internalized. But now, you see, what I've done is I've delegated all that to a device. And while GPS has been a true blessing to me many times, it's prevented me from getting lost in so many ways. It's helped me get places quicker than I would have otherwise. It helps me find places I've never been relatively easily. So I'm grateful. But what it has done for me is it has weakened my ability to tell north from south, weakened my ability to remember how to get to someplace. You know, things like, I don't even, you know, this is totally different technology, but I don't know my wife's phone number, right? Because all I have to do is hit a button, right? So that's really nothing to do with, but you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like the GPS has changed me and it's actually changed my brain, right? It's actually rewired my brain. All of us, it has. Is that bad? Well, it might be if I'm lost somewhere and I don't have a satellite above me that, you know, there's a skill that I've lost. And if I'm aware of that, then I maybe can manage it. But let's not pretend that even a good technology that we use for good hasn't changed our brains and how we think. We should at least be aware of that. So what is this doing? You know, again, we could look through, you know, writing, and we've talked about GPS, other technologies to see, well, what do they enhance? What human ability or capacity that's natural, does it enhance for good? But it has also affected us in other ways. What are those? And what does that mean? that's how one way I would start to lead into the ethics. And it's theology in the sense that it's the theology of what a human is. You know, what we call theological anthropology. What does it mean to be human? Well, that's not just a theological comment, because there's sociology and philosophy and medicine and so forth to help answer that question. But those are some of the ways I would start to begin to talk about the morality of it. And, you know, at one point someone mentioned is, you know, what's the ethical thing? What's the theological thing? What's the moral thing? Usually when I use the terminology morality or moral or ethics, ethical, I'm using those as synonyms. There are some ways to use those differently, but I'm just saying in this conversation, I may say moral one place and ethical one other place. I'm using those as synonyms.
So I feel like we are only now starting to truly grapple with the moral implications of social media.
Oh, yeah.
And that's been going now for like, what, 20 years? More or something. I don't know. It's close to 20 years, 20-ish years. A score.
Good old MySpace.
So we haven't really even like, we're only now like, huh, this is, there's some real problems coming out of this. And what does this mean? What should we do? And so now there's AI, and it seems unlikely it's going to slow things down at all. So if it takes us 20 years to actually grapple with something, I don't know. Like, are there other things that are we haven't like we're that what's the 10 the thing that's 10 years old that we haven't gotten to yet that now we see AI, but we're all consumed with that, but we didn't get around to the thing that's 10 years old. I don't know. Did it used to happen so quick? the ethical changes that or like the ethical considerations of things that you need to grapple with, because yeah, we haven't even figured out how to regulate social media, and now there's I don't know how many different AI what their unit is called. AIs are they intelligences? But they're out there.
Yeah,
they're just going to keep coming. Do we have an obligation to grapple with it ethically? Like, is that something that we have an obligation because if we don't use it, then we don't have to grapple with it?
Can we jump off this crazy train? Yeah. Is that your question?
Yes, maybe.
Is that even possible, though? It's everywhere.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, if you're using GPS, right, if you're using any social media, if you're shopping online, if you're using Google, a search engine is AI.
Dang it.
Right.
Can't get away from it.
Uh-huh. So, I mean, someone can go off the grid, right? But that's not likely that very many people choose to do that or even be able to. I mean, how would you do that? So I don't think we have the luxury of not grappling with it because we live in the world, right? We live in the world. And just think of it this way. I mean, think of it in terms of vocation, right? That we have an obligation and a joyful obligation, a freedom to serve our neighbor, right? To be Christ for someone else, a little Christ for someone else. And so if this thing could be damaging, we should care about how it may damage us and impact our ability to serve the Lord in numerous vocations. But how is it harming my neighbor? I should care if I think that this is harming children, if I think this is creating new addictions, if I think this is creating a public health crisis, you know, or mental health crisis. And I actually think it's even worse than all those things. I think social media can have all the effects I just mentioned, but I mean, I think AI is even potentially more pernicious than those things, which I'll say maybe in a second. As a bioethicist, we talk about this kind of thing all the time because medical technologies are advancing. Therapies, new therapies and skills and drugs are coming at us more rapidly than we have, because it takes time to evaluate something.
Right.
You don't just...
We don't really have time.
You're right. You really don't want to be... Except with those glaring things, you really don't want to be someone that is kind of a knee-jerk reactionary to, I mean, of course, there are glaring examples where you should immediately respond, you know, but with, you know, if someone comes along with some new gene therapy or something like that, you know, it may go against my yuck factor, my instinct, but I need to take time, right, to say, okay, well, what are we actually doing? What does this mean? What would it mean if we don't do it? Et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So in bioethics, that's common, right? Things are changing so quickly. We can do more and more or different things we never dreamed of faster and faster, sooner and sooner. And we don't have time to sit back and reflect on it. That's what we're experiencing here. Mm-hmm. You know, I can't slow down time and we can't slow down the rate of technology unless there's some way to legislate that. But I think we still have the obligation, even if it feels like we're losing the race, that, you know, the outcome is not really in our hands. Mm. Right. I mean, but we're called to, and I think to be a good witness to our belief in God as the creator and redeemer of all things, right? That he has set the whole cosmos into and reconciled himself to. So that plus, again, how do I serve my neighbor best? And that means how do I protect my neighbor, right? It's the fifth commandment is how Luther explains the fifth commandment. Not only should I not, you know, bludgeon someone to death, but I should prevent someone else from doing it if I can.
Right? Yeah, and maybe make them both lunch.
Well, yeah, it's amazing what eating with people, how much that can solve tension, right? Yeah. Meals are great healing things. Yeah. But yeah, I back to kind of how it weakens our normal capacities, because Rachel's a writer and all of us write into some ways. And so I've kind of come to the conclusion, Rachel, maybe you agree or don't, but I've kind of come to the conclusion that I don't want my students to use spell check. Because they're not learning how to spell. Mm. You don't, you know, I noticed my spelling's gotten worse because when I want to write things on the board, I'm waiting for the whiteboard to, you know, show me what's wrong with it. my actual ability to, when I'm not using my laptop to write things, I think my spelling is getting worse. I'm forgetting how to spell things.
Yep.
And my students are never learning how to spell words correctly because the thing changes it for them. And we learn by mistakes.
Yeah.
You don't learn how to spell if you don't have to spell ever. And the same goes with grammar checks. I mean, I'm the same. I mean, I'm starting to become kind of a monster to my students, and it's hard to enforce it. But it's like, I don't want you using anything for grammar. I mean, you know, I don't know if I can be absolutist, but I'm trying to be absolutist about it because I want you to learn how to write because, well, we can talk about the benefits of knowing how to write well. But do you get my point? It's like,
yeah,
these things are great tools. And I guess maybe as a last thing, if I'm going to submit an article for publication or something, after I've done all the hard work, then run it through something to see if I've missed anything.
Mm-hmm. Although, truth be told, as an editor, I disagree with Grammarly on things.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes. They don't have all the answers all the time.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Yes. I am feeling this very deeply right now because I am currently a grad student and I get Grammarly from Concordia Irvine. Mm-hmm. And so I have to write a lot of papers, and that's one form of AI that I'm using mm-hmm. as I'm writing my papers. It doesn't change things for me, thankfully, but it does tell me where I should be looking and the things that I should be doing. And that is kind of the last check that I do when I write a paper. I try to write stuff as best as I can, and then I go through and run through Grammarly and delete all the ones I don't agree with. But there's a lot of stuff that it's like, this isn't clear. You should rewrite it this way. And I'm like, great. Yes, that sounds awesome. And I don't actually have to retype that. It retypes mm-hmm. it for me. And that's just like, that seems to be a fine or accepted use mm-hmm. of that kind of AI. But you're totally right about spelling. I used to like win spelling bees and stuff in grade school. There's some words I can't spell for the life of me now because I don't have to. Mm-hmm. And I know that I can tell over time I've been losing that ability. And my poor mother, if she listens to this, is going to be like, oh, Sarah, because she's in English. She's in English.
Okay. I still can't spell Connecticut right the first time. And I lived there for 3 years.
Yeah. Yeah. But like, I really feel that using these technologies does take away some skills mm-hmm. that would be really good for me to just know how to do. And this happens too in radio technology. I mean, we use AI stuff now that didn't exist 4 years ago to help us edit audio better and to make sound better. And those things, I mean, yes, we may lose a little bit of skill of like editing audio, but I think that is an even separate category of things that it's just enhancing our work. It's making everything sound better. But then I feel like the question is, well, then the goal is progress. And then it's like, oh, well, doing things even better all the time is the goal then in that category of stuff. Mm-hmm. And I mean, that leads you down a different path of, you know, how much are we going to be pursuing success and pursuing good as like the ultimate goal of everything and losing, you know, losing the forest for the trees or however that goes. But like, I'm bad with metaphors. But like there's just so many things to consider because AI is in so many different things that we use. And a lot of it does make our lives a lot easier. I mean, it makes our radio stuff sound incredibly so much better than it used to 4 years ago, but pre-pandemic. And that's been awesome for us. But like there's other things too that we can record our voices and then we can have an AI version of a voice and we can make it say whatever we want to say. And that is gets into the vocation talk. Mm-hmm. Of like, I mean, that is has huge ethical implications of like, if there is an AI that can make me say whatever, and that's available for somebody to just type something in, and then my voice sounds like it's saying something, that has really wild implications of truth and trust and mm-hmm. all sorts of different stuff. So like, this is, it's just infiltrates into so many different areas of life. I don't even have a question.
I have a question based on this, because I keep hearing us talk about uses, specific uses of AI. Mm-hmm. Like, Sarah, you use it to take the ums out of our podcast recordings. Thank you for that.
It's beautiful.
Aaron, I just used Google AI to look up how do I go off grid. And
I love that.
So am I using Google AI when I just type?
Yes, you can't turn it off. So step one is buy a rural home, by the way.
Good. Step two, learn to not use your phone all the time.
My question for you, Pastor Stiegemeier, is what would you consider good, bad, and neutral uses of AI? Like, could you give us a couple of examples of each so we can maybe guide ourselves a bit more?
I will do my best.
Okay.
So just, frankly, right back to the Grammarly thing, because, I mean, the way Sarah clarified it a second ago, I think it's fine if these things alert you to a problem or potential problem. But when it redoes it for you, or you can get some, you know, you can tell whatever, ChatGPT, blah, 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 whatever they call it tomorrow, you know, improve this text, right? Or polish this rough text, and then it rewrites it for you. Yeah, that's different. So using it as a tool is one thing, where it actually, like I said, it's alerting you to potential errors. And then you are still in the seat of judgment on that. But like I said, it's through making mistakes that you learn. So if it's just fixed, it's like you're parenting a child. If you just cook their meals for them their entire lives, never teach them how to peel an egg, then when they're on their own, they're helpless in the kitchen. So we need to learn skills. Mm-hmm. And especially the skills of communication using words. And that doesn't just mean writing, it means speaking. Don't you want to, when you're talking to someone, you're trying to persuade them, say on a radio show, you want to use good grammar, you know, or at least pretty good, because it wrecks your credibility if you are speaking your own language poorly. Mm-hmm. And if Grammarly is fixing all these things, then I think that will affect not only how well you write grammatically, but how well you can think or speak grammatically. It's all interconnected.
Yeah.
And another thing you mentioned that made me think, Sarah, I think, was mentioning how you can use now AI to take your voice, right? The sounds and the various vibrations that make up your voice, your unique sound, and give it any text. So it sounds like Sarah Gulsis is saying some horrible blasphemies or something like that. And the person doesn't know because it's almost indetectable. We can also do this, or we're going to be able to do this, we think, with images, right? I can take Marilyn Monroe's image and have some kind of new, or even someone alive, right? Let's take someone like Tom Hanks and let's make a vile movie with him in it. And that's an insult to him, right? That's robbing him of his, it's attacking him. And what you're doing then is you're not using AI as a tool. You're using AI as a person. And that's where I think we really are sliding off into some danger zone, right? That's affecting how we think of other people. But to Rachel's point, I do think that how we use things, this is going to be hard, and we're going to have to look at things case by case, and we're going to have to talk about things. We're not going to want to exaggerate, because that also wrecks credibility. Don't use logical fallacies when you're kind of trying to talk about things. Don't freak out at every difference, right? Every change, but be critical and accept the fact that you may make mistakes and change your mind. But I think the one principle I would be trying to keep in mind at the forefront is, how does this serve my neighbor? And how does this, like I was saying before with the Marshall McLuhan observation, this is enhancing a capacity, like editing the audio, right? But what human capacity is being weakened? I don't know that it's a major part of human capacity that you are not needing to change the ums, right? But if it's if it comes to, and then I'm going to say one more point, and I think Rachel will get this, all of you will, because I tell my students this all the time, that clear writing and clear thinking are the same skill.
Mm. Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. If you cannot write your thoughts clearly, then you don't understand your thoughts clearly. They are the same skill. And so when we say, I'm going to write like a really, you know, suboptimal paragraph, because, you know, students are doing this all the time. They're it's cheating, but they'll take, you know, they'll have like a really rough paragraph, run it through something, and it'll make it sound a lot better. And then they're never learning how to say their thinking clearly, because they're just giving it and something else paraphrase it, which may get it wrong from what your intentions were. Because these things are not perfect, and they don't always know what's in your mind. So those are things that I think are dehumanizing. Because again, that's, I think, a very key thing that separates human beings from the animal kingdom, is our ability to think, reason, and communicate with words. Mm-hmm. And we could go expand that, right? Creativity, right? The ability to have an idea and create a beautiful painting, or at least maybe even a challenging painting or poem. Mm-hmm. You know, my dog is smart, right? He knows certain words. He can evaluate my tone of voice. I think he can, you know, gauge my emotions to some extent. Like, my dog's pretty smart, but he'll never be a stand-up comedian, or he's never going to, you know, appreciate a sonnet. That takes a different kind of brain, which we have. As the kind of, even if individual human beings have varying levels of development and ability, in general, the human brain, right, can do those things. Yeah. And we're softening that. We're homogenizing it, right? That's the other thing. It takes away individual expression. It's more homogeneous and less distinctive. And I think that is, in very maybe not obvious ways to people right away, is it's an attack on the image of God. When you attack the image of God, you're attacking God, right? If I have a photo of myself and you guys throw darts at it, you're insulting me. But don't tell me. Don't tell me.
Yeah,
don't tell me. I'd rather be in ignorance of those sorts of things. But you get it. But you get it, right? If we are in some sense, right, creationally bearers of the image of God, the devil can't strike God, but he can strike us. And that is really anger and hatred towards God. Anyway, that's what I'm trying to say, is how does this serve my neighbor? And what does this say about my humanity, those distinctive features that make me different from my beloved dog?
What I hear you saying is that AI can be used well if it is a tool to enhance human activity rather than a tool to replace, you know, human creativity, reason, etc. That, you know, don't let it do the work for you. But if it can help you do the work that God has given you to do, then sure, use it.
Yeah, I think in limited ways like that, that requires discernment and wisdom. I mean, so some possible applications, and it's already being done, applications of AI technologies would be, say, in medicine. Mm-hmm. If AI can help diagnose symptoms more quickly, then I may get healed sooner, right? If it takes, you know, months of trial and error, then that's more suffering. But if AI can help, you know, scan tons of data instantly, then maybe it will take some of the trial and error out of treatment, which would be good, a human good, right? I think. Mm-hmm. Or it may help develop drugs faster, or it may, you know, all kinds of therapies, or do research faster by being able to just access information at a much greater volume. Or in law, I mean, if you have a lawyer that can use AI pretty reliably, let's say, to go through all the precedents of all the court cases in an evening, rather than having to spend, you know, 10 paralegal, you know, for days, maybe you'll get your judgment sooner. So I could see AI being a tool in those ways that might replace like paralegals or, you know, some things like that. So we have to, I mean, the whole question of putting people out of work by automating things, that's a part of the moral discussion for sure, too.
Okay, you mentioned things aren't always what they seem, right? Images, text,
papers that students turn in. And I think a big part, at least for me, and I suppose for other people too, that always comes up with AI is trust. Like, how on earth do I know that what I see on the internet is real? Like, I've started to just not trust anything. Like, I'm looking at pictures and like looking for that sixth finger, because that's typically the tell. If there's a picture of a person, you look at their fingers, because AI has a hard time getting fingers right. It's really odd. But like, there's been pictures going around.
Right. AI has been a thing for what, 30 minutes? Right now.
Well, so what are we going to do when they figure out the six finger problem?
There'll be another tell. And, but like, after the North Carolina floods, there was this picture going around and it was heart-wrenching. It was this adorable girl and her dog, and she was in the middle of a flood, and people were having this emotional response about this image, and it was AI. I mean, this was totally a created image. It was not real, but it was viral on my feed. And it just felt so strange that like people were having this very real and appropriate emotional response, but about a picture that wasn't even real, about a situation that was real. So it's like the trust factor of not even knowing if what I'm seeing was done by a human or not is just strange.
To an extent, I feel like this gets back to, we have yet to grapple with, so social media, take it back further, internet.
The
like,
internet.
We still haven't properly grappled
with
that.
The internet.
Are on the internet real? Are they real?
I don't know.
Are the images real? They aren't. That's not truth. It could always have been manipulated. That is not a real thing. We've made it a real thing. We've decided it's a real thing, but that's not a real thing. And so, like, we have not grappled with it. And now we're like, that's 30 years. So with 30 years ago, we haven't fully grappled with it. We're starting to be like, and now we're to AI. It wasn't real to begin with, but we persuaded ourselves it was real and we had real emotions, but it wasn't real. It was never real. And I don't even know, but I think that's part of it. Like, we declared that it was true, that you could trust something. We decided that it wasn't true.
Yeah.
We decided we could trust it. It was never true.
So question,
truth with a capital T.
Well,
it was always just pixels. And why did we decide that we could trust pixels?
Because we wanted to.
Yeah. So question for Pastor Stiegemeyer, going all the way back to the Gospels and Pontius Pilate, what is truth? And how does this relate to AI?
Oh, well done. Well done, Rachel.
I see what you did there. Uh-huh. I see what you did there. Very clever. Yeah. I mean, so there's manipulation. You're manipulating someone's emotions. Images are great at that.
Yeah.
That is one of the best things images can do, good or evil, is that they operate on a different kind of consciousness, a nonverbal level that is feeling and intuition based and response that's very powerful and can be very strong. So I could show you, say, an AI picture that looks utterly realistic of a girl carrying her kitten through the floodwaters, for the purpose of, you know, creating or, you know, pushing forward sympathy in donors who will then use their energies and resources to help children like that. So that's a seemingly a good thing, right? You're trying to do, but then I could also do an image like that to cause you to hate someone by having them doing a vile act, right? Where, you know, if were true, hate would be a proper response or, you know, anger maybe.
Yeah.
And so, it's not, why this is so dangerous is because it's not just about manipulating individuals, but masses of people quickly and easily. Anyone can do these things. Almost anyone, you know, to be able to use Photoshop or those, you know, all sorts of ways that you could try to manipulate images often took a lot of skill, special equipment. And but now almost anyone can have access to these kinds of things and create images or sounds or representations that can, you know, manipulate the feelings and then the action. If you can manipulate someone's feelings, then you have you can manipulate how they will act, right? Mm-hmm. If I'm mad or if I'm extremely empathetic or feel bad about something, I may do things, right, because of those things. And that's, so you can use this for, it's not just that you can use this for good or evil, but you can use it for tremendous good or tremendous evil. That's what makes this a little different. Is the scope.
The scale, yeah.
Yeah, power and the scope of it. And it is untruthful. It is deceptive. And You know, human life, we could not subsist in a society if we didn't have the presumption of truth, right? So if I had to investigate every single statement you say, then we'd never be able to relate, right? I mean, if, you know, Sarah says that, you know, this technology takes out the, you know, ums and things in the South. Well, if I can't just believe you, I don't have to check you, do I? I don't have to fact check that. I just believe what you said. And because I believe what you said, the conversation can continue on. So the way we operate with other human beings is that we assume truthfulness unless there's a reason not to. Mm-hmm. But now that confidence is shaken much more so than previous kinds of technologies, right? That's kind of some of my reflection on that.
And it makes us feel especially vulnerable, because if you wanted to fact check Sarah on the audio software, how would you do it? You would ask a search engine, which would ask AI. Mm-hmm. And so there are very few opportunities for us to actually confirm the truth of anything we're hearing or seeing, because to do so would require us to go back to the very same sources that may be corrupted.
Yeah. And that's why we got to be still able to be analog, right? I mean, if I've got books, right, they may be wrong too, but it's a lot harder for you to change all the books on this subject, you know, than maybe to change the, you know, online presence when those things substitute for analog or hard material. So there are advantages to being, you know, remaining analog, or, you know, being able to use hard copies for things like that too, or at least knowing about it, right? Not just, so whereas we used to be able to trust, and you should always be a little skeptical. Like you hear things on the news, right? There's healthy skepticism. But, you know, when newscasters are interpreting what's going on in the LA fires, you might want to make sure, you know, that there's, you know, their interpretations are accurate. But the fact that there are LA fires, you know, if you can't trust any of those, or including pictures, right? You know, you can't trust anything. And we have the danger of sliding into this point where I don't know if what I'm seeing is real ever. Mm-hmm. And without that certainty, or that presumed certainty, it'll be very hard to function.
Yeah. Human beings could not pull off a hoax as big as the LA fires, but AI might be able to.
Right. Very good.
And that is very sobering.
Or at least pull it off long enough to make something happen. Maybe eventually we'll figure that out. Oh, it was a hoax, but you know, maybe we can use that to rise up a militia or something. I don't know. I mean,
you heard it here, folks.
you know, maybe I'm giving people ideas. You know, I'm not trying to give you ideas for ways to manipulate masses of people instantly.
So far, we've talked a lot about the sort of inner aspects of AI. Could we take a step back and talk about some of the external features of it? We mentioned already how it's coming from many of our jobs, paralegals, editors, college professors, radio editors. A lot of people are rightly nervous about what this is going to look like for their livelihoods. That's one issue. The other issue is the enormous amount of power that AI supposedly needs to function, and the fact that all sorts of energy conversations that were hard enough already regarding responsible ways to secure enough energy for our society to function have a new edge to them. So what are some of the logistical, infrastructure, societal issues on the outside, the back end of the AI that we need to be thinking about?
Yeah, great observation.
Nuclear energy. Finally, right. It's going to make the comeback it deserves.
Those are good observations, though. Seriously, Rachel, because in medical ethics, we would call that something like distributive justice or resource allocation.
Gotcha.
Right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So in healthcare, we do not have infinite resources. We only have certain number of hospital beds. There are only so many ventilator machines, right? And so sometimes decisions have to be made here or there, hard decisions, maybe even life or death decisions in certain contexts, based on what resources we have, because we don't have infinite resources.
No.
And that can apply to many, many parts of life. And so that's what we call distribute. In other words, is it just or fair how you distribute things? And there's a lot to go with that. But I think that's, you know, resource allocation. So I was formerly a pastor in a church, and that means sometimes you're overseeing a budget creation. And a budget can be like a theological statement, because how you budget your resources in a church is basically how you're defining what you're going to do as a church, right? In other words, it says what's important to you, mm-hmm. right? If you're going to want to do all these things, but you're not going to pay your ministry, right? Pay for the clergy, for instance, or give them, you really, you know, whatever. You get it. You get my point.
Oh, yeah.
How you allocate scarce resources, or if not scarce, limited, how you distribute or apportion limited resources tells us what your values are, okay? And so, at least to some extent. So if we are saying we're going to expend X number of, however you quantify power, electricity, because I really don't know. But if you're going to determine that this is the need for space to hold computers and preserve, keep them, and you know, all the kind of things that, like you said, infrastructure, how many people have to get degrees and go through training to deal with these things. And plus, you're going to have lots of safeguards. How do we prevent, like, you know, foreign powers from infiltrating, you know, our AI? Yeah, that's how I line that up, is I see that as kind of, well, what's the just and fair way? Because even if you're trying to do something good, if you do something good here, but you're sucking away resources from somewhere else, that may be causing, you know, harm overall, right? So I don't know. I mean, I can't give like specific, you know, figures about things. I do think it's part of the discussion. I think mm-hmm. I think that's part of the discussion. What is this? It's a cost benefit analysis.
Yeah.
Right. What is this costing us materially or in human hours? And is that in good proportion to the benefit or the harms, right? So, yeah. What we do is we tend to rush, right? We're just quick. And especially with things like this, because money is to be made. There will be money to be made by being on top of this technology. And yeah. So people are going to rush through things without having the hard thinking and taking the time to weigh it first. And that's one of the troubles.
Yeah.
Yeah. I know a lot of the conversations about being fair and being just, it's just how AI is even created, how all of the information that was fed into it or right. is being fed into it, artists and authors and people being, I mean, there's implications of like copyright law, like it's taking copyrighted works and you're creating things off of copyrighted works. Are you taking away somebody's livelihood because of taking away somebody's work that they did? Like there's implications even on that end too, of the work that things are being based off of.
Right. I mean, it's plagiarism. It's taking credit for something you didn't do or yeah. create, you know, unless you somehow build in a way to footnote all these things. Yeah. Right. And so, yeah. So an honesty element is there for sure. But even like, you know, so as a professor, right, students are handing in AI generated papers all the time. And I think most of the time I can tell how well I mm-hmm. can police that. I just know if I've had 10 conversations with a person, I have an idea of how well they put words together.
Yeah.
Right. And so now if I receive a paper from that same individual, that's, you know, light years above. You know, it's amazing to me how in the last couple of years, how many of my undergrads are suddenly PhD writers, right? PhD right. level. Dissertation. I mean, they're handing in papers to me that are way beyond the skill level of anyone in the class. It's obvious, but how can I prove it? Well, you have to change assignments. We're working on how do we change assignments? I'm making more things more oral. You know, you have to come and tell me things. We're working on ways, and it's an absolute nightmare.
Yeah. When I was an English comp teacher instructor 20 years ago, it was still a problem then. Mm-hmm. And I could always tell because mm-hmm. human beings have a signature style. Just like if you're walking down the street 100 yards away from me, I can tell by the way you walk mm-hmm. who you are. Mm-hmm. And a writing style is the same. Now, as a teacher back then, I could always tell that they hadn't written it. Mm-hmm. Usually I could find out where they got it from. Mm-hmm. Sometimes I couldn't. And that was so frustrating. I know you didn't write this. Your girlfriend must love you a whole lot. But now everyone has AI for that. Is there a way for you as a teacher to confirm that? Is there like a footprint that you can find it and prove that it was AI generated?
Well, yes, kind of. So so some of the bigger corporations or whatever that are doing this, say ChatGPT, one thing they're now starting to offer to universities is like anything that is taken from ChatGPT, you know, copy and paste it or whatever, will have a watermark.
Ah, okay.
And but and the manufacturer of ChatGPT, well, they'll just do that. And so, okay, but we have to pay for that service.
Of course.
And how many different companies are doing it? How many subscriptions can we actually literally do? And still there's going to be some student who's going to be able to find, you know, some other engine, you know,
workaround.
So it's not like there's no safeguards, but how effective? So we're all trying to figure out how to create different kinds of assignments.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. That are harder, much harder. Like I said, I mean, I'm doing more oral exams. I don't have enough time to do individual oral exams with 75 students every semester.
Yeah.
But I have a class in ethics that is 16 students, and they're going to have an oral. Instead of making them write an essay on a Luther text, which I would have done in the past, you know, here's an essay. Now they have to come in one-on-one, and I interview them, and they have to know it or they don't know it. They, you know, But, you know, how
now we can say that like confirmation examination is serving a practical.
Yeah.
Like, yeah.
Like, yep. People are constantly being like, oh, it's so traumatic. But no, it is preparing you. Mm-hmm. It was always preparing you. But we can tie it more directly. This is a great thing for your kids to learn how to talk about what they believe.
Yeah.
At that age.
It's so funny that we started this conversation about Plato and talking about how writing, you forget stuff. And we are right back where we started because AI is causing us to have to speak what we know.
Wow.
Plato. That's brilliant, Sarah. That's you're right. Oh, my gosh. Yeah. We didn't plan that.
I know. It's beautiful.
It's a miracle. It's an AI miracle.
AI had nothing. Do not give AI credit for this one.
It's a radio miracle.
It was all us and maybe the Lord.
Yeah.
Okay. I cannot let you go. We've talked about medicine. We've talked about education and some of the implications. I've been asked to ask you a question.
Ooh. Okay.
One of my children is competing in a Christian speech and debate league in Lincoln Douglas style debate. Mm. And their resolution this year is about automation in combat.
Oh.
Okay.
And so, she heard that I was going to be speaking to an ethics person. And she said, please, will you ask him his opinion? So the resolution is this, and then I'll just let you run with it a little bit. And you would be doing her a great favor, and you will have one more teenage listener on this episode.
Well, that's awesome.
And the resolution is this. In combat, the use of automation should be valued above the use of military personnel.
So in other words, like using drones.
Mm-hmm.
Right. To do the fighting.
And more than just, you know, human piloted drones, AI piloted drones.
Yeah. Right. Or, you know, they're creating all kinds of robotic type, you know, like I've seen like prototypes of like what looks like a dog.
Robot right? dogs. Yes.
Yeah. That have
kamikaze
guns on,
robot dogs.
That have guns on them or explosives. And so if I understand the debate point, the resolution, mm-hmm. you're saying that it is much better to fight using all that material and therefore save human lives. Is that what, you know?
Yeah. And she's got to be able to argue both sides.
Okay.
But any insight, like it's such a thorny problem because of course you want to save lives. Of course you want to avoid combat exposure for our people. But is that all that's going on here?
Okay. You're going to love this.
Okay.
Or at least some of your listeners are going to love this. I am going to draw my answer, at least partially, from a Star Trek episode.
Nice.
The original series.
Oh, you know, boy.
William Shatner, Leonard Nimoy. Okay.
Wow. Okay.
Now, I wasn't prepared for this question, so it's been a few years since
I'm so
I've seen
sorry.
It. Well, no, that's what's great.
He was ready.
On
Look.
Point.
I have literally thought about this before.
Mm-hmm.
And so have the writers and producers of Star Trek. So there was an episode, in all seriousness, there was an episode in this science fiction drama of a planet where the two great civilizations were at war. And they'd been at war for like, I don't know, 600 years or something like that. And so the Star Trek Enterprise, they're kind of investigating or getting to know these people or trying to learn about the culture or whatever. And what they realized is that without human cost, there's no motivation to ever end the fighting, right? So So what then these societies did to kind of first of all, they're having like robots doing all the fighting, and they realize, well, that's not going to give us any motivation to ever stop or have peace. So then they devised a system where it'd be like a lottery. So, you know, if your robots get killed, then randomly citizens have to go in and get executed, right? A certain number of them. It's kind of a weird drama, right? And I don't know how this applies exactly, but this is how it applies. I think that in a weird and perhaps bizarre way, there should be human cost, right? I mean, there should be human cost. Anything you fight, if we're truly fighting over values, right? By which I mean, whatever, to protect the innocent or et cetera, a justifiable fight, a just war. You know, I don't think the best thing is to just attack their property, right? Their program. You want to get to the mind. There is still ultimately a mind involved, a mind intent to kill. Mm-hmm. And that's what you got to stop, right? And unfortunately, that might require actually ending that person's life or, debilitating them or something like this. I'm giving a half articulated answer to that, you know, because it's not something I've really thought about deeply. But that's what I'm saying is I think in war, I mean, I would like for nobody to get injured or killed ever for anything. But if we're fighting to defend, truly defend our ally, defend them, then we need to do what it takes, I believe, to make that evil stop. There are, and that's what we would call historically a justifiable war or a just war. You can kill in the purpose of defense. So if there's no human cost, we might tolerate bad behavior and mistreatment, in the name of compassion.
Yeah. If war is just my robots going to blow up your robots, it can go on for a long time. There's nobody has skin in the game.
Yes. And not
and
only
then does anything ever change?
Nothing changes. Yeah. It's just whoever runs out of resources first. But then it actually gamifies, right? It actually gamifies, or funizes, gamifies. We talk about gamification and, education and assignments and things like this. It gamifies combat or conflict or world conflict. And listen, there are, if you don't have anything, okay, this may sound weird just saying it this way, but if there's nothing for which you'd be willing to die for, right? Or even nothing for which you'd be willing to kill for, right? Then maybe we're not truly human. I mean, like, for instance, if someone came after my family, I hope I would be willing to die for them. But I also think I'd be willing, if I had to, kill for them. So if someone's coming after my family, there has to be some reason you're fighting. Mm-hmm. If there's a reason you're fighting, if it's a serious reason, then it might require actual human cost in order to fight for peace. I don't know. That's kind of a reflection.
Helpful.
That's a reflection.
Yeah. No, I appreciate that. And sure. I imagine there will be a lot of interested teenagers in this debate league who will be very interested to hear this interview. Well,
I'm in favor of that, no matter what.
I know. You already came out in favor of oral examination. So there we go. Yeah. I would like to end coming back around to a final takeaway from God's word and from our Christian worldview. Like, how are we to regard this very troubling, very exciting, very scary set of new technologies as Christians?
Well, so, I mean, I like to do a lot of my ethical thinking from the perspective of Eden, the Garden of Eden, because I think all ethical behavior, you have to know what a thing is, right? You got to know what a person is, a human being is. And I've always given this example in my classes. They've heard this many, many times in different ways that, if I have an object or a tool, real quickly, if I gave you five little baggies of white powder and say, eat those, what's your first question going to be? What is it? Right? Mm-hmm. Because it might be rat poison, it might be plaster, it might be salt, et cetera. You got to know what it is before
be pixie sticks. I love those.
Right. There might be lots of good things. It might be vanilla pudding mix. We could go on and on, but it might be toxic too. Right. And so you got to know what a thing is before you know how you can regard it and how you may treat it. And I think the same thing with any ethical behavior, whether we're talking about race relations or justifiable war or economics, et cetera. You got to know what a thing is. And here by thing, I mean human being. You got to know what a human being is. And from knowing that, understanding what a human being is, no matter where they're from, what they look like, or what they can do, if you have a pretty good grip on that, it will inform how you may regard them, view them, and how you treat them. And so that's where I think we have to, so much of the way we, our life in the world today has to come back down, boil down to that. And C.S. Lewis has some great quotes in his essay, The Weight of Glory, which I won't go on to, but he has some really great quotes about the glory and majesty of a human being, obviously very corrupted or in you know, hidden by the evils and sinfulness. But because of the fall, we didn't become non-humans, right? We're not beasts. We're still humans. And so there's still something dignified in simply that, even though we are unrighteous on our own. So that's where I go. I mean, I think that we will grow in love towards one another. We will grow in patience towards one another. We will want to treat people the way we would want to be treated. The more we kind of reinforce our teaching of what it means to be created by God in his image for the purpose that we are created. I mean, why did God create Adam and Eve? I mean, he didn't do it because he was lonely. The best answer I think we can give, why did God create Adam and Eve, is because he just simply wanted to love them, right? I mean, he wanted to love them. And what's the meaning of being a human? First and foremost, to be loved by the creator. You know, the reason you exist is to be loved. Now that changes how I think of myself, and that will change how I think of you. If I see myself as, first of all, God's object of his divine love, then wow, that transforms my heart, right? And I think that's where life comes. So whether we're talking about AI or any kind of technologies that may affect how we treat other people, we got to know what they are, and we have to talk about it and reinforce it. And we can do it positively and talk about the beautiful things about it, about human beings. And that's where I think we should go.
Okay. So awesome. To use AI responsibly, we need to remember who we are. We need to figure out what it is. Mm-hmm. We need to know first and foremost that we are loved, and we need to talk about it, which is what we've done here for the last hour and a little bit. This is awesome.
Yeah.
Thanks for the opportunity. I always enjoy talking to you.
Yeah, Pastor Stegmaier, thanks so much for joining us. It was a fun conversation.
Yeah, thank you.
Ladies, you can join this conversation too if you have other questions or comments or reactions to anything that we brought up today. You can do that in our Facebook group, the Lutheran Ladies Lounge, also on our Instagram page at Lutheran Ladies Lounge. You can find all of our episodes at KFUO.org/Lutheran Ladies Lounge or on your favorite podcasting app or on the KFUO radio app. You're listening to the Lutheran Ladies Lounge podcast. I'm Sarah.
I'm Erin.
And I'm Rachel.
Views and opinions expressed on the Lutheran Ladies Lounge podcast may not represent the official position of the management or ownership of KFUO Radio, the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. The Lutheran Ladies Lounge is produced by KFUO Radio and available at KFUO.org or wherever you get your podcasts. Don't forget to hit that subscribe button and leave a review for us too. If you love the Lutheran Ladies Lounge podcast, consider financially supporting our producer, KFUO Radio, so we can keep doing what we do. Find out how at KFUO.org/give.
I was wondering where that voice was coming from. Sinister low voice.
That's our Erin.